parent to the Supreme Court decision on the Muslim ban, on the anti-abortion clinics, on breaking down labor, on Justice Kennedy retiring and us having to, you know, think about what our Supreme Court is going to look like for the next 30, 40 years, I feel inspired. I feel inspired by women from across the country who came here to risk arrest and say we're not going to sit back when this injustice is happening. So the world is pretty messed up.
And that does it for our show. Special thanks to Renee Feltz, Hani Massoud, Sam Alkoff, Laura Gottesdiener, Libby Rainey, Dennis Moynihan, and to our team in New York, Mike Burke, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Sharina Nadura, Nat Needham, and to our crew here in Brownsville, John Lance, Tom Fitzgerald, Dan Teachworth, Kurt Kirkendall, Claudia, and Maria Luisa. Democracy Now! Has job openings for full-time news producer. Check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. We broadcast from the Mexico-Texas border.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock and 22 seconds. And coming up next is your KBOO Evening News. While we're waiting for the KBOO Evening News to get started, we just want to always say thank you very much to all of our KBOO members out there. Not a KBOO member? Why don't you go on to kboo.fm and you can always click on that donate button and consider supporting community radio today, because hey, it brings you stuff like your KBOO Evening News, the volunteer newscast brought to you 5 days a week. Here we get going.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an unidentified man was shot and killed by the Portland State University police following their response to a disturbance call.
More details are revealed about the Capitol Gazette shooting in Annapolis, Maryland.
The California legislature passed one of the strictest data privacy bills in the United States.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 29th, 2018. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Ruben Lawrence. An unidentified man was shot and killed by the Portland State University police following their response to a disturbance call around 1:30 a.m. The shooting occurred outside of the Cheerful Tortoise, a sports bar located on Southwest 6th Avenue. According to the Portland Police website, PSU Police Department officers contacted the people believed to be involved in the disturbance. Shortly after contacting the suspects, PSU police officers broadcast that shots had been fired. The subject was pronounced dead at the scene. The Portland Police Bureau Homicide Detail, Forensic Evidence Division, Multnomah County District's Attorney Office, Oregon State Medical Examiner's Office, and the Portland State University Police Department will be conducting an investigation into this shooting. Surveillance and cell phone videos of the incident are reportedly being examined, as well as eyewitness interviews are taking place. Currently, the name of the subject and the officers involved have not been released. However, according to the Portland Police Bureau, quote, following the grand jury, the Bureau will release additional information as appropriate, end quote.
Five people were killed and two injured in a shooting that took place Thursday afternoon, June 28th, in Annapolis, Maryland, at the Capitol Gazette, a local newspaper. The building's exits were barricaded before the shooting in what was a pre-planned attack by 38-year-old Jared W. Ramos, who was hiding under a desk. Ramos had purchased a pump shotgun legally, states the CapitolGazette.com, the website for the newsroom targeted in the shooting. Ramos targeted the station 5 years before the shooting, attempting and failing to file a lawsuit against a columnist and the paper in 2012. The lawsuit was over an article covering a harassment charge against him. The story covered the harassment of one of Ramos's former female classmates, in which he pled guilty to a misdemeanor charge. The local Annapolis newspaper reported that Ramos had sent the woman numerous expletive messages telling her to kill herself after asking for her help. In 2015, the lawsuit was dismissed. Ramos appealed the case again, but the appeal was later rejected and dropped. Since then, Ramos turned to social media using photos of the reporters involved and the owner of the news publication as his profile picture and background banner on his Twitter account. In the years since, sources say Ramos became a recluse, never attending family functions even after the death of his grandmother. According to the Baltimore Sun, a news publication in Baltimore, Maryland, Ramos worked for the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics and has a computer science degree. Vielka Ramos, his aunt, told the Sun that Ramos, quote, wasn't close to anyone, end quote, was, quote, very intelligent and a loner, end quote, and that she was in disbelief over the shooting. Friday, Ramos was charged with 5 counts of first-degree murder with no bail.
Yesterday, on June 28, 2018, the California legislature passed one of the strictest data privacy bills in the United States. Assembly Bill 375 overhauls the previous personal and business data privacy protections in a drastic way. From the text of AB 375, quote, beginning January 1, 2020, the bill would grant a consumer a right to request a business to disclose the categories and specific pieces of personal information that it collects about the consumer, the categories of sources from which that information is collected, the business purposes for collecting or selling the information, and the categories of third parties with which the information is shared, end quote. This admittedly hurried bill comes unsurprisingly following the news that Facebook had allowed political firm Cambridge Analytica to gather the data of 87 million Americans without their consent prior to the 2016 election. The wave to pass data privacy legislation has been especially heavy following the Facebook scandal, and the California legislature is not the first legislative body to have passed data protection legislation. In fact, the General Data Protection Regulation has been passed in the European Union, requiring companies to disclose what data they're collecting and to receive the user's consent, as well as provide a portable copy of each user's data if requested. Even in California, a ballot initiative named the California Consumer Privacy Act, nearly identical to AB 375, was filed, and the measure had garnered the support of approximately 625,000 signatures. The differences between AB 375 and the California Consumer Privacy Act can be found in the fines imposed, with the fines in the initiative being tenfold that in the bill, and the way in which companies must disclose how your data is sold. The ballot initiative states that companies will be required to be transparent about any sharing or selling of the data, while the bill only specifies selling, meaning the data could be passed around a family of companies. Additionally, the ballot initiative specifies that companies must be upfront about exactly where the data was sold, whereas the bill only requires companies to disclose what category of company the data was sold to. However, now that AB 375 has passed the California legislature, the sponsors of the California Consumer Privacy Act have vowed to withdraw the initiative. Despite the ballot measure being more stringent, Alastair McTaggart, the sponsor of the ballot initiative, said, quote, "We are content both the legislative solution and our initiative provide tremendously increased privacy rights to Californians," end quote. While consumers rejoice, the tech industry disappointedly accepts the fact that California consumers' information will be much less viable as a tool for market analysis. Although the tech industry poured $2 million into an association fighting against the bill, quote, the Committee to Protect California Jobs, the legislature passed AB 375 unanimously, indicating the highly bipartisan nature of consumer protection legislation and the possibility of such legislation being adopted by other states.
This Sunday, Oregon residents will be 75 cents richer by the hour. That's if you were on minimum wage. As on Sunday, July 1st, Oregon's minimum wage goes up. Portland's metro area residents will now be making a $12 minimum wage. For the standard Oregon minimum wage, workers will be receiving $10.75. Rural Oregon residents will be receiving $10.50 as their minimum wage. The Senate Bill 1532, which is the yearly minimum wage raise bill, was approved in 2016. The bill was implemented the following year, with Portland's wages going up by 15%. The goal is to cap the minimum wage off at $14.75 by the year 2022 in the Portland area. By 2019, Oregon residents should expect to see the minimum wage go up by 50 cents and then back to the yearly 75-cent raise 3 years later. Oregon holds a place in having one of the highest hourly minimum wages in the country.
Tom Richmond is an illustrator and caricaturist for Mad Magazine. He's hosting a workshop at the Wacom Experience Center starting today to Sunday. KBOO journalist Kyle Carrezzi spoke with Tom as he gears up for his weekend in Portland. The full interview will air on the KBOO Evening News next week, where you can hear about the art of caricature, Mad Magazine's place in American satire, and Alfred E. Newman. Here's a sample of that interview.
When you're doing caricatures of people, what features do you tend to exaggerate when you draw them?
Well, that's entirely up to the person, you know, because a caricature really is exaggerating what it is about the person that makes them unique. So the features are just the tools you use to relay that. So I'm really trying to caricature their personality or their presence, you know. So you don't key in on any one particular feature. It's just sort of all of them, how they work together and how you want to exaggerate that person's presence.
Can you give an example of someone you've drawn when you've exaggerated, like what it feels like to be with them or who they are as a person?
Yeah, like, one of the things I do mainly for Mad is the movie and TV parodies. So when I caricature somebody, like, for example, I recently did one of the new Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi, for Mad. And so I'm caricaturing Mark Hamill, but what I'm really doing is caricaturing Luke Skywalker, you know, so mm-hmm. his character is what I'm trying to bring out. So he was very, you know, gruff and intense. And so his facial expressions, I would exaggerate his brow and how his eyes kind of crinkle together and, you know, the set of his mouth and things like that. And so I'm trying to bring out his personality as much as his features.
Mm-hmm. And I was, maybe like a month back, I was reading some Mad Magazine issues from the 1960s, and it had some really scathing satire in it. So do you think you can talk a bit about the impact that Mad had on the public and it's with the satire and humor?
Well, back in those days, I mean, Mad was a satire. I mean, that was the defining satire of the generation. You know, we didn't have the Daily Show or the Onion or, you know, the Colbert Show or Saturday Night Live. Mad was the place that you got that sort of work, that which made it so unique. That humor was pretty much them. And nowadays, things like the Daily Show and the Onion and stuff, they all were sort of, you know, evolved from Mad Magazine. So Mad created this whole genre of satire and snarky commentary that's so prevalent, especially these days on the internet.
And can you talk a little bit more about the Wacom workshop you're doing this weekend while you're in town?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I've been doing the last year and a half or so is I've been teaching workshops, weekend workshops on how to draw caricatures. It's just something I started doing and it really caught on, and I've been traveling all around the world actually doing them. I'm doing one this weekend here in Portland. Wacom is sponsoring it for me, and it's at their Experience Center. And what I do is I sit down with this very small group. It's like 12 to 14 students, and we talk about and draw all weekend long and just dissect faces. And I'm trying to show them how I look at faces and how I try to interpret them and what I look for to exaggerate and how to capture somebody's likeness and exaggerate and create a caricature from a model. And it's a lot of fun. Get a very diverse group of artists. Some people are consummate pros that have been doing caricatures for a long time, and some people are real beginners. But it's always a lot of fun and truly a high energy, very creative time.
This is just, I guess, this is a random question, But about how many times have you drawn Alfred E. Newman?
Well, if you're talking about the magazine, probably 50 times, 60 times. I don't do covers too often. I've only done a couple. So, and he's always on the cover, of course. But I try to sneak him into my parodies every once in a while, just in the background or whatever. But when I do like comic conventions or somebody asks me to do a sketch for them, I oftentimes draw Alfred. So I'm sure I've drawn him several thousand times by now, if you include all those.
That was Kyle Carrezzi speaking with Mad Magazine illustrator Tom Richmond.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterpoint at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio News, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather in the Portland metro area will be mostly clear with a low of 60. This weekend, expect mostly clear skies and highs in the 80s. Today in history, back in 1926, fascists in Rome add an hour to the workday for economic efficiency.
French President Emmanuel Macron has announced his plan for a revived compulsory national service, a common promise of his campaign for France's teenagers. President Macron believes that compulsory national service, regardless of the sector, will create a social cohesion throughout France and promote the importance of each individual civic duty. While this rhetoric was fierce throughout Macron's campaign, his newly unveiled plan, named the Universal National Service, is a subdued version of his original intentions. During his campaign, Macron discussed his proposed national service plan as entailing 1 month of, quote, direct experience of military life, end quote, between the ages of 18 and 21. However, on Wednesday, Macron announced his plan that requires 16-year-olds to engage in a two-phase program. The first phase will place the youth in a role that focuses on civic culture for a month. According to BBC, there are a variety of placement options being explored, such as volunteer teaching, working with charities, or traditional police/fire service. Following completion of the first phase, the 16-year-olds then have the option to serve for at least 3 months in a multitude of areas. Participants will be encouraged to serve in an area linked to security or defense, but service in areas of cultural heritage, environmental preservation, or social work will be available as well. The program will not be financially conservative, costing 1.75 billion euros up front and an additional 1.6 billion euros each year. Macron's plan has warranted some controversy from youth organizations and internal working groups alike. For one, the working group tasked with researching the logistics of the program has warned Macron that his administration the plan may violate a portion of the French constitution that prohibits the state from forcing a group of the population to be away from home. Additionally, a number of youth organizations pointed out inconsistencies in Macron's plan and cited freedom of choice arguments in attempts to backpedal the plan. Macron's political opposition, Marine Le Pen of the National Front, also criticized the move in stating, quote, "What will they learn in 1 month? Nothing. Mr. Macron would be better off scrapping the idea altogether," end quote. However, according to a YouGov poll collected in March, around 60% of the French population is in favor of the revived national service. However, when solely younger people were surveyed, the percentage of those in favor dropped to slightly below half, according to BBC.
In conjunction with the story of the current Mexican election, the importance of Mexican Revolution and the way it impacted Mexican politics deserves a look. Beginning with pre-revolution in 1876, Porfirio Diaz was in power as a dictator following revolts against the Juarez and Lerdo de Tejada presidencies. During the fledgling period of the Diaz presidency, his administration was not revered for their notable public improvements, but rather for their ability to maintain peace and stability throughout Mexico. The 30 years in which Diaz retained dictatorship were marked by the destruction of local and regional leaderships, ensuring that Diaz's circle of legislators, judges, and advisors were kept tight. Britannica describes Diaz's reign as orderly and systematic with a military spirit, end quote. With Diaz pandering to a variety of interest groups, often pitting them against each other. The economics of the Diaz presidency were less than stellar, although admittedly not as bad as the result of the rampant encouragement of foreign capital usage. Up until 1910, the economy of Mexico had been slowly growing, but the wealth had not been distributed equally throughout the country, and most profits remained in the hands of the wealthy. In 1908, Diaz announced that he would be retiring from the presidency shortly, stating he believed Mexico was ready for democracy. The political opposition quickly realized the necessity of capitalizing on this statement and scrambled to find a worthy candidate in Francisco Madero. He was known for his book La Sucesión Presidencial in 1910, which called for honest elections, significant participation in the political process, and not allowing for a president to be immediately reelected. In 1909, Diaz revoked his vow to resign and instead allowed Madero to run against him. This election, predictably by the people of Mexico, was a farce, and Madero was thrown into jail on the eve of the election for inciting a rebellion. Following Madero's release from jail, Madero briefly fled to San Antonio, Texas, and wrote another book in which he declared himself the rightful president of Mexico. Under the wings of the military generals Pascual Orozco and Pancho Villa, Madero was able to lead a successful revolt against the Diaz administration, and with Diaz fleeing to Europe in 1911. While Madero's presidency was marked by attempts at democratic reform, such as ending the policy of immediate reelection and ensuring that middle-class citizens were able to participate in the political process, it didn't endure, and movements to overthrow the Madero administration emerged. At the head of these movements was Felix Diaz, nephew of Porfirio Diaz, as well as Madero's former fellow revolutionaries, Orozco and Bernardo Reyes. Although the Madero administration was able to suppress these movements, as well as jailing Diaz and Reyes, Madero was eventually brought down by one of his own generals. That general, General Huerta, was in command of the government troops and, with help from Diaz and Reyes, was easily able to overthrow the Madero administration. This has been a brief glimpse at some of Mexico's history. Corruption and social inequality are issues then, just like they are now in this coming election, with many Mexicans hoping for a change.
The Supreme Court of the United Kingdom ruled unanimously that the previously held Civil Partnership Act of 2004, which had outlined the ability for same-sex couples to enter into civil partnerships as opposed to getting married, was blatantly inequitable with the adhesion to the European Convention on Human Rights. As Rebecca Steinfeld and Charles Keaton, the appellants of the case, exited the courthouse, they were quoted as feeling elated that the court had ruled in their favor. This, in turn, allows Steinfeld and Keaton to move one step closer to being able to enter into a civil partnership. While the judgment does not require the parliament to change the existing law or to create a new piece of legislation, it does put pressure on them to act now. Currently, mixed-sex couples in the UK are not able to enter into civil partnerships as a result of the 2004 Civil Partnership Act. During its inception, the Civil Partnership Act was implemented in order to allow same-sex couples to reap the benefits of the financial and legal protections, such as inheritance and next-of-kin arrangements offered by marriage if the relationship were to end. In 2013, the Marriage Act was passed by Parliament, making same-sex marriage legal in England and Wales. While same-sex couples now had the choice of entering into a civil partnership or getting married, mixed-sex couples remained only able to get married, much to the chagrin of some mixed-sex couples. In the case of Steinfeld and Keaton, they believed that the institution of marriage was based on the flawed morals of patriarchy and people being property. In a civil partnership, however, the co-joining of partners is free of the religious connotations of marriage while benefiting from, quote, legal and financial protection for both parties in the event of the relationship ending, like in a marriage, end quote. The judgment written by Lord Kerr with Lady, Lady Hale, Lord Wilson, Lord Reed, and Lady Black in agreement identified that when the Marriage Act was passed in 2013, it would have been necessary to either revoke the ability for same-sex couples to enter into civil partnerships or to extend that right to different-sex couples. Seeing as it would be profoundly unjust to absolve the nearly 63,000 civil partnerships entered into by same-sex couples since 2004, Parliament left the issue of mixed-sex couples not having a choice in legal partnership unaddressed in the 2013 Marriage Act. In acknowledging that members of the LGBTQ community had faced decades of injustice in regards to legal partnerships prior to the Civil Partnership Act, Peter Tatchell also noted the inequity presented for all people in this case and was quoted saying, quote, "It was never fair that same-sex couples had two options, civil partnerships and civil marriages, whereas opposite-sex partners had only one option, marriage," end quote. With over 130,000 signatures gathered in support of civil partnerships for everyone, the prospects of Parliament passing legislation to allow civil partnerships for both same-sex and mixed-sex couples appears likely.
The retirement of Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy sent shockwaves through the political left earlier this week. To many, the judicial future in the United States looks grim, and there's no doubt that we'll see a major Supreme Court shift to the right going forward. As we head towards this year's midterm elections, KBOO's Ray Bodwell is reminded that all elections have consequences.
The announced retirement of Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy has created a sense of doom among liberals and progressives across the country, and rightfully so. Kennedy is the so-called swing vote on the bench, deemed to be midway between Justices Breyer, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Bader Ginsburg on the left, and Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, and Chief Justice Roberts on the right. But historically, Kennedy has often been well to the right of center. He voted to strike down Washington, D.C.'s ordinance against handguns, and he wrote the majority decision in the Citizens United case that defined corporations as people and released a flood of corporate dollars into American politics. This year alone, he voted with the conservatives to limit public sector unions, support Ohio's aggressive purging of its voter rolls, allow Trump's travel ban, and block California's law requiring crisis pregnancy centers to provide information about abortions. Hardly what most of us would describe as a centrist. Still, he was generally supportive of Roe v. Wade, he voted against the Homophobic Defense of Marriage Act, and he wrote the majority decision in the case that legalized same-sex marriage, a ruling that many have compared with Brown versus the Board of Education and Roe v. Wade in terms of social importance. That's certainly better than nothing, but with his retirement, our elected racist, misogynist, xenophobe in chief will get to put another right-wing zealot in the mold of Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch on the bench. And if we assume that he finishes just one four-year term, Donald Trump may have the opportunity to appoint two more justices. After all, Stephen Breyer is already 79 and Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 85. As it is, whoever Trump nominates to replace Kennedy is guaranteed to shift the court. So, bearing in mind the ages of the current conservative majority, we can expect an extremely conservative court for at least the next 10 to 15 years. And if Trump gets to replace Breyer or Bader Ginsburg, court would likely remain in conservative hands for at least a generation. That's right, 25 years. The point that I'm trying to make here is not that we're screwed for the foreseeable future as far as the Supreme Court is concerned. That's blatantly apparent. It's just a reminder that elections have consequences. All elections. With only 58% of voting age citizens casting votes, the 2016 general election had the lowest voter turnout in 20 years. And less than 50% of the voters in the 18 to 29 demographic voted. I get it. I was angry that Bernie got shafted, and I thought Hillary was an uninspiring candidate. But after 18 months of the Trump regime, is there anyone out there that thinks she wouldn't have been an infinitely better president than what we have now? But it's not just presidential elections that are consequential. Poor as the turnout is for presidential elections, it usually falls way off for the midterm elections between presidential votes. But it was midterm elections that allowed Mitch McConnell and the Republicans to take control of the U.S. Senate in 2014. And here's just one very consequential result of that election. As Majority Leader, McConnell was able to block a vote on Merrick Garland, President Obama's choice to succeed Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court. Then, a little more than 3 months into Trump's first year, McConnell and his Republican majority changed the voting rules so that nominees to the court could be confirmed by a simple majority, allowing Neil Gorsuch to be confirmed. The Republican majority that swept into the House and Senate in 2014 is what has allowed Trump to do so much damage since his election in 2016. The Republicans are currently in full control of all three branches of the federal government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. Trump has been placing conservative judges at all levels, and with his upcoming ability to stack the Supreme Court, the judicial appears to be lost for years to come. And the next presidential election doesn't roll around again until 2020. So with that in mind, we're starting to count down to another critically important midterm election. All 435 seats in the House of Representatives and 35 seats in the Senate are up for grabs this year. Voter apathy this time could be suicidal. If the Republicans retain congressional control, you can look forward to more right-wing judges, a continued commitment to fossil fuels, further erosion of the social safety net, a rollback of reproductive rights, and an end to the Affordable Care Act, to name just a few. If you care about any of these things, you must vote against Trump's Republicans and for the candidate that has the best chance to beat them, even if that candidate is uninspiring. None of us can sit this one out, and we must work together to make sure that a blue wave washes as many Republicans as possible out of Congress this November. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
You're listening to the Cape. You're listening to the. Sorry about that. We're professional around here. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation.